Hey, witches. Llewellyn has a book out that we wanted to make sure you knew all about. It is called Houseplant Horticulture by Devin Hunter. It talks about infusing magic into every act of indoor plant care. No plant is ever just a houseplant. Whether you're a green witch or merely horticurious, you can learn how to successfully grow potted plants, connect with their spiritual energies, and partner with them for magic. Houseplant Horticulture also includes a foreword by Juliet Diaz, author of Plant Witchery, and illustrations by Ciolo Thompson, creator of the Hedgewick Botanical Oracle. So grab your gardening gloves and save 20% on Houseplant Horticulture by Devin Hunter. Use coupon code HORT20 at Llewellyn.com. The coupon is valid from April 10th through April 30th. It is not valid in conjunction with other discounts or previously placed orders. Note that you do need to be logged into your Llewellyn account for the coupon code to apply. That's HORT20 at Llewellyn.com. Check it out.
The path of the witch is so unique.
The gift of witchcraft.
I was able to see, hear, and communicate with spirits.
A very personal relationship between a person and spirit.
Carnal lust and fun things like that.
Working with different energies and spirits and communicating.
Creating magic.
Powerful ritual.
The role of the witch is to make change.
Bless it be, y'all. Bless it be. People ask me, like, okay, I'm a witch, and I don't know what to do.
20 years ago, three young friends realized they were witches. They scattered to different parts of the world, following magic and spirit. Now, they're back in their hometown to share what they've learned.
Welcome to That Witch Life Podcast, your home for living as a witch in today's world.
Three, two, one, clap.
Clap.
That was centuries late. Let's do it again. Three, two, one, clap.
Clap.
All right, close enough.
I have to say it when you point before you even say clap, and I'm still late. I don't know what to tell you. My laptop is just,
you're,
it takes its sweet,
late,
precious time.
Corey, leave us in. This is funny.
It's what I do. It's what I do. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of That Witch Life Podcast. I am your host, Kanani, and I am joined by...
Courtney. This is what Kanani feels like when somebody comes in days late on their cue.
Yes, that's my job. You don't do it as well as I do. I do it with much more pizzazz, much more flash and pizzazz. Hillary is not with us tonight because she is unfortunately not feeling very well. So you are just going to have to contend with the two of us, which means it's not going to go well. I apologize.
I know.
Right now, it's not going to go well.
And it's me. I'm, quote, our friend Taylor Swift. It is me. It's the problem. It's me. Because, like, you two do a great smooth intro when I'm not here. And when it's just the two of us.
Well, it's always been a consensus that you're the problem. That was always the consensus. That's not a new thing. We've all known that for years. You are the instigator. You are the problem.
My God. Like, one of the reasons Hillary's not with us is just because the allergies out here right now are so bad that they just literally, like, kicked her poor self on her ass. And honestly, I am almost there with her. Not as bad as where she's at, but it's like the full body. This environment doesn't love me. It sucks. It's been so rough, but yeah, let's not make this a whole podcast about allergies because, except that they really suck. Yeah, spring is like such a weird time, especially in Oregon.
I love spring. I've got my tulips are coming up. My yard, I'm finally starting to do things in my yard. My house is finally starting to come back together. I still have to put my office back together. I am not going to be able to have the office back together before the mini con, which makes me sad, but it's all a work in progress, and at least there's progress. And so I'm taking the wins where I can get them because they seem to be few and far between. So I'm enjoying the nice weather while we have it.
Yeah, and since this is coming out after the mini-con, we should just say, wow, wasn't it a smashing success? It was so great. We haven't had it yet.
I mean,
listeners,
I don't want to say that my workshop was better than yours, but I think that we already know that that's just, it's just going to be phenomenal.
Did you even show up for your workshop? Because, like you didn't know how to use your microphone again. And we had to text you and find you. So there was just this really awkward pause. And then you forgot to put on, you forgot to wear pants. And then you forgot you weren't wearing pants. And then you like got
all
up.
All the tracks.
Yeah. So what an awkward moment during your workshop, Kanani.
I mean, it wouldn't be my workshop if there weren't a multitude of awkward moments. I mean, that's just kind of what I bring to the table.
When we introduced you and you were like, is this a con? And we're like, yeah. Am I teaching now? Yeah. What am I teaching? The workshop that you submitted, I don't remember what that was. Like, we just had to spend the first 15 minutes of your workshop reminding you of what you were teaching.
Exactly. That sounds about right. All that tracks. All that makes perfect sense to me. So I don't know about you. I don't know if it's because the solar eclipse is coming up. I realize all this is going to have happened later, but this, I think other people will probably relate to this when they hear it possibly. I have had the weirdest, most realistic dreams over the last like few nights. Like, they're not weird, like crazy fantastical. They're super realistic, but just crazy. Like, it's almost like alternate, my dreams are like alternate realities. Mm. Like people that are in my life or have been in my life, but it's as if like my life had gone a different way. And like, this is what my life would have been had you done this. I've had just the last few nights.
Oh my God. Is there a world where you married Landon? Is there a world where that happened? Is that what you're seeing?
That was in one of the dreams.
Oh my God. This Landon was in one of the dreams. School boyfriend.
Yes. Oh my God. That was one of the dreams. And there was another dream that involved someone else that I'm not with anymore. And it was like as if time had just kind of continued in that way. But what's funny is, and I think it's because my children were meant to be my children are always my children. So even when I have different weird, strange dreams where everything else about my life is different, my children are always my children. And yeah, there's just certain weird things about me like that I'm very strange. And apologies to anyone that I'm with or anyone that I date, because I'm such a faithful non-cheater that in my dreams, if I have sex with someone who's not my partner, I've killed my partner. So it's not cheating. My partner's dead to me in my dream. Like, they're dead. I'm some sort of a widow situation. So it's not actually cheating. I just kill them off. That's easier for me to stomach than the thought of being unfaithful to someone. I just kill off my partner in my dream.
Those memes those memes where it's like, it shows a guy says, I don't have to worry about my wife cheating. I have to worry about her running the car without oil, forgetting to lock the front door, losing her wallet again. Like, I always send those to Brian, and he's like, yeah. He's like, I'm worried you're going to burn the house down, but I don't worry about you cheating because you don't have time. I'm like, I honestly don't.
It's not about time for me. It's about tolerance for other humans. I have none. You don't need to worry about me ever cheating or being unfaithful. You do genuinely need to have a slight bit of concern. I may end up in jail somewhere and need bail money. That is something that should always kind of rattle around and be a real possibility in someone's mind.
You say that, Kanani, but here's what would actually happen is that you tend to sit just out of the drama, but keeping a close eye on it, and you clock the whole thing, and you would exit the situation about 45 seconds before the cops close in.
That is true.
And you would already be.
I'm really good at not getting caught. You're not wrong.
Yeah, she would. Yeah, so Kanani always makes it sound like she's the instigator. No, she's the one who stands by and just casts a lot of judgment. Very harsh judgment.
This is true.
And then she talks about, I would be in jail. I'm like, no. You would be looking at the perpetrators, judging them and being like, you guys are really, really gross. I'm leaving. That's what would happen. That is what would happen.
You're not wrong.
Like, I'm probably the one that would end up laughing so hard that I don't notice that the cops show up and they haul me away.
1,000% you would go to jail. You would go to jail in a second. I'm saying I would go to jail because I'm so enraged that I've decided that jail is the better option and I've accepted my fate. You would go to jail because you had no idea what was going on around you and didn't even realize that the entire crowd had dispersed. And it's just and you your squeaky wet pants in the middle of the floor. Yeah. And the cops have no choice but to take
you. Now, that's the cartoon podcast version of me. The true version of me absolutely knows when the cops are showing up because I have been so close to arrest so many times. You know, old school protester, that it's like, I see the signs. I know when that big old wagon shows up and they're coming for us. Did I tell you about like how my ex Sag left me in the middle? This was like after, I don't know if I've actually told the story on the podcast. This might be one story.
I don't know if you told on the podcast, but I do remember when this happened.
Yeah. So this was just after W blew up Saddam's palace and we were going to war, and it was, I was in opposition. I still am. I think most people are at this point over here. But we got a lot of flack, those of us that were speaking up against it. Oh, you're not supporting your country. And now everyone's like, that was kind of a mistake, I think. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be making light of such a horrific situation, but that's kind of the mentality about this. But I was, the night that, you know, that the troops went in and started started bombing Iraq, I was part of a group of people that blocked off an intersection in downtown Portland. Shady area then, not as shady as it is now. It's gotten shadier, but it was pretty shady then. And we blocked off the intersection. And my situationship at the time showed up with me. And as soon as the cops started closing in, he looked at me and he said, "Call me when you get out." And he ran and he hid behind a mailbox.
I remember.
Yeah. And I remember telling Brian that story.
That's how you pick a winner.
That's how you pick a winner. And I was telling Brian that story, and I was just kind of telling it offhanded, like, oh yeah, I'm not going to say his name. Oh yeah, he just went and hid behind a mailbox. And Brian's just looking at me and he's like, wow, what a hero. You know what I would have done? I'm like, what? And he goes, I would have picked your ass up, swung you over my shoulder, carried you out, and nagged the shit out of you all the way home for getting yourself into a situation where you might have gotten killed or arrested. Oh my God. And I was like, yep, that's Brian Hoover, man. He saves the day and nags you the entire way home. Like, but yeah, that's why when we ran into my ex. My God.
That's so bad.
We ran into my ex and he was with his new girlfriend. I was so close to saying, don't bring him to a protest.
That's perfect.
He likes to hide behind the mailbox. I'm like, but I didn't. And we say I should.
I've known men similar to both scenarios. I don't know that, yeah, I've been with anyone who was
left you in the middle of a protest with, yeah, a cop.
I've never had anyone leave me.
We're firing
like that,
into the crowd,
in fact,
firing guns into the crowd and showing up with batons, and he left you there.
No. I once had someone, and this didn't surprise me because they're very even still protective of me, but we were on a MAX train and there was some sort of a scuffle and like a really bad fight that broke out. And I, being me and having no idea what's going on at any given time and just like looking at the butterflies inside my head, was just kind of standing there in my la-la space. And all of a sudden he reaches over, grabs me and pushed me down into a chair. And I'm about to like, you know, rip his nuts off because I'm like, you know, how dare you? And then all of a sudden I realize he's standing in front of me, blocking me from this like really escalated situation. And he's like protecting me from it. And I was like, oh, you're not a douche canoe. Look at you being a nice guy. So I didn't murder him after that. But
oh, yeah, I would have clocked that.
Typically what happens.
We joke about like that. I would not know what was going on. But the truth is, because of that, like that experience and experience being in Occupy Wall Street and living in New York City and being around a lot of drunks with a lot of mental issues in the artist scene that I used to work with, like used to do stuff with, I have actually turned out I'm pretty good at diffusing a fight. Now, if it's between men with weapons, I'm not diffusing. I'm getting the fuck out. But like,
exactly.
I've learned. Like there was a fight that broke out in the bathroom at Ruby's at Coney Island, and I managed the whole situation. And then I came, like, I was in there, and this woman just she'd had too much to drink. She popped off at somebody else. And I started like directing traffic, like, you stay out there. This is happening. Okay, you can go in that. And then I came back and sat down and Brian's like, you were in there a while. And I just kind of said nonchalantly, like, yeah, there was a fight. I had to break it up. And he's like, what? And I'm like, it's fine. It's over now.
It's good now. It's totally fine. I think my vigilance is completely dependent on my situation and who I'm with. If I'm with my children, I can see all the things. If it's just me, I think it depends on how mentally distracted I am. I'd love to say I'm super vigilant. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. If I'm with certain people I trust, like this person, I will tend to not really worry about it because I know that they're paying attention to the situation better than I can. But so I think it kind of, for me, it's kind of situational. But yeah, no, it's different life experiences definitely give you different levels of kind of understanding and what situations you need to be very present in versus other situations.
Yeah. And, like,
yeah.
I mean, the kind of the flighty wacko version of me that most people see, that evaporates very quickly when the shit is going down. Like I shift completely down to this, you know, very calm. We're going to be so serious. Like we're taking care of this. And I probably get a little scary looking, to be honest, but it's just, you've been through enough of the situations. You're like, we just need to get to this next point. You know, even like, we have to fight, not to fight them. It's like, nope, we are going to do this. We're going to step here. We're going to go like that. And it doesn't, I don't want to make it sound like I'm tempting any of that, but it's like, you don't know what you're going to be like in any given situation until you're in it. I knew this guy, actually he's a former bookstore owner in New York City. And he was telling me the story and he describes himself. This is like how he describes himself as just, you know, he goes, I'm just kind of, you know, I'm not a big scary guy. And he's pretty petite, you know, real sweet, very bookish. You know, you don't see him and you don't look at him and go, oh wow, this guy would totally, but he told me about, you know, that he had never really seen himself as anybody that would ever, he didn't see himself as a hero type. He's like, I'm the bookish guy. I'm not the hero. But he was at a party and somebody pulled a gun and without even thinking, he stood up, grabbed his girlfriend, threw her over his shoulder and he ran out. And he's not a big man. His girlfriend was very small, but my guess is that he was on adrenaline and he kicked into this and he was like, wow, I'm kind of a hero. I'm like, well, you don't know what you're going to be like until you're in that situation. You can think you're so tough and think I this and that, because I'll tell somebody, blah, 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 blah. But until you're actually faced with real danger, you may not be that person. You could be the person who shuts down. And there may be circumstances. Yeah.
I've started watching Grey's Anatomy because I watch shows like decades when they're not on anymore.
Yeah.
And so I finally just started watching Grey's Anatomy
last week.
Exactly. And there was this hilarious episode of, I mean, the event isn't a hilarious thought, but where there was a shooter I think it was in a restaurant or it was in a bar or a club or something. So all of a sudden there's like lots of people that go into the hospital with gunshot wounds. And of these people, two of them actually had been kind of maimed. They weren't fatally wounded by any means. One had been shot. It was a couple and they were engaged. He had used his girlfriend, his fiance, as a human shield. And so in the hospital, they're like fighting and he convinces her, you know, I would never do that again. I can't believe I did that. And so how he got shot was she got shot through her arm and it hit his arm because it had gone through her because he had used her as a human shield. And so at some point in the episode, he's convinced her, I would never do that. And you're just the love of my life and blah, blah, blah. And then at the end, there is another active shooter situation. And he hid behind her again. And she was like, We're done. It's over. No, thank you. Hard pass. And she walks away.
I would say, oh, who would give a guy a second chance? I mean, I went home with my situationship after he went and hid behind the mailbox.
Right.
And I continued to be in a situationship with him off and on. Well, it's because of a situationship for the next few years. And And then he was surprised years later when I told him I never want to speak to him ever again. Like It's just
right. Anyway. Well, it's just it's one of those, you know, I think it's next level if you have like fight or flight. I think yes. Some people just naturally they're not going to be the one that's going to jump in front of someone. And I'm not even going to fault them for that. Their instinct is they're just going to flee. And yeah. That's what they're going to do.
That's very
and
human.
I'm not even saying that's wrong.
That's
it's very
legit human.
It's human. Very human.
Yes.
It's, however, next level to grab your fiance and use her as a human shield.
Yep.
That's a little worse.
Yep.
That's not good.
Yep. Well, I have a super cool announcement. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but I'm mentioning it again because for folks that are interested, it is now time to apply. Applications are open for Meeting at the Ford, a Morgan Immersion, which I am co-leading with Laura O'Brien, John O'Sullivan, and Yawo Carla Gaskins Nathan in November up in the Columbia River Gorge. So I had a phenomenal virtual conversation with Laura. As of this recording, it'll be a little over a week ago, and just such great insight, so many powerful moments, and really just great people coming together. I love this kind of stuff. And Laura and John are coming to the Pacific Northwest this November, and we're going to co-lead an immersion focused on the Morgan. So it's different than your typical pagan retreat because it's really about people that are looking to make some profound changes in their lives. And they want the guidance of the Morgan. So it's great if you know all the myths. It's great if you know all the information about the Morgan. But if you're not taking that information and using it to better yourself and strengthen your community, then it's all for nothing. And so that's why we want people to come together and, you know, get this opportunity to learn about the Morgan from an authentic Native Irish source. And also just take some of the applications that, you know, I've done in my facilitation work, that Yawo Carla Gaskins Nathan has done in their wholeness and wellness work, and really make some profound changes in your life. So if y'all are ready, and also this is up in Bingen, Washington, an absolutely gorgeous area over the Columbia River, and it's at a spa hotel. It's phenomenal food. It's gorgeous scenery. We're going to have a tour of the different waterfalls with some local guides. It's just going to be, what everybody really, really needs it to be. I just know it. And so if y'all are interested, it's on my website, CourtneyAWeber.com. That is Weber with one B, not two. And there's a link at the top that says Morgan Immersion. You click on that. It gives you all the information about the immersion and the application. And applications are already coming in. I'm like blown away that it's happening so fast. Yeah. And it'd be really, really great to, you know, see some applications from TWL listeners. So yay.
So yay.
So yay.
So yeah, I think that's going to be really fun. I think people are really going to really look forward to that. I think I'm super excited because we are actually soon going to be talking to Morgan Daimler.
Yes!
About their new book, Celtic Fairies in North America, which is that's one of my favorite things to
in the world
to discuss
ever.
is the Fae. So absolutely. And so I'm super excited to hear from them and what they have to say. But in the meantime, I think we're going to take a sponsor break.
Yeah.
We are so excited about our new sponsor partnership with Luna & Company Soapery. Luna & Co. is an enchanting soapery with the purpose of elevating your magic through the art of self-care. As witches, this husband and wife team that are behind Luna & Co. Soapery have passionately handcrafted natural soaps and ritual oils with intention. I have not only used them myself, but I have also personally gifted many of their soaps and body oils, and I cannot get enough of them.
They are fantastic. We have included them in our subscription boxes, and I personally have been using their Brigid soap in some of my cleansing rituals. They have all kinds of handcrafted natural soaps that are really great for your skin, but they are truly magical. And so it's a really wonderful way to incorporate magic into your everyday self-care routine.
Agree. I use the Hecate soap, and it is absolutely lush. It is so good. Their meticulously crafted planetary and goddess collections are more than just soaps. They are sacred creations, ritually consecrated with the profound intention of helping you channel the unique energies of planets and goddesses in your spell work, rituals, and manifestations.
That is so true. And whether you're just taking a quick shower or a leisurely bath, Luna & Co. Soapery creates a potent tool for personal transformation and spiritual growth. You can elevate your magic and amplify your manifestations with Luna & Co. Soapery. I can personally say I love their Luna and Persephone soaps. They are my favorites.
You can find Luna & Co. Soapery on Instagram at Luna Co. Soap and at their website at lunacosoap.com. Luna & Co. Soapery ships domestically, but they also ship internationally,
yeah.
Friends. So for international shipping, please contact them directly prior to purchasing. And everybody can get 15% off your order when you use code LUNAWITCH15. That's LUNAWITCH15.
Thank you so much to Luna & Co. Soapery for being an episode sponsor. We cannot tell you how many witches have gotten hooked on Jasmine Pearl tea.
Well, it's friggin' delicious.
And you Jasmine Pearl fans, they have a whole array of absolutely phenomenal winter teas to keep you warm and comforted through these next few cold and miserable months.
Like their Golden Fire Tea, every sip of that tea is an adventure. The turmeric brings warmth and grounding that combines with a zesty kick of ginger and cayenne to create a glow of flavors that dance on your tongue. More than just the taste, Golden Fire heals you from within. It's perfect for those wintry days when you need a bit of warmth, and you can even try it as a latte.
And let's talk wellness. This tea isn't just a delight to the senses, it's a guardian for your well-being, especially during cold and flu season. It feels like a nurturing shield, fortifying and protecting.
A tea that has become a personal favorite of mine, especially during these challenging times, is the Well-Being Blend. It's not just any tea. It's like a comforting friend, offering support when you need it most. Imagine a blend of elderberries, echinacea, red clover, and rose hips. Each sip feels like it's boosting your immune system, perfect for those days when you feel a bit off or have been around others or under the weather yourself. And the peppermint in this tea, it's incredibly refreshing, especially if you're feeling stuffed up.
Hold on, let me bring you a sip of serenity. A moment of tranquility, will we? Courtesy of Jasmine Pearl's exquisite Tranquility Green Tea, close your eyes and envision lush Chinese tea gardens where each leaf whispers the secrets of centuries-old traditions. This isn't just a tea. It's an invitation to embark on a journey of peace and harmony. Breathe in the essence of this carefully cultivated leaf. A sip can take you on a sensory journey that transports you to a place of calm, where time slows down and every moment is savored. Disclaimer, Tranquility Green Tea experiences may include a heightened sense of inner calm, a peaceful disposition, and a newfound appreciation for the artistry of Chinese green tea.
Supporting small businesses are very important to us, and the Jasmine Pearl is a family-owned tea importer and specialty tea blender, which is based in Portland, Oregon, and they have been crafting tea blends for 17 years and direct sourcing teas from origin since 2004. Their blending and sourcing philosophy is based in the love of fine teas and herbs, which is why they focus on blending with exceptional ingredients, hand blending each batch using mainly organic ingredients, and wow, does it show.
Check out these phenomenal teas at thejasminepearl.com. Save 10% with the new coupon code WITCH2024. That's WITCH2024. Free shipping on orders over $35. Make sure you let them know you heard about them on That Witch Life podcast. And thank you to Jasmine Pearl for being an episode sponsor.
We are so excited today because we are joined by Morgan Daimler. Morgan Daimler is a witch and folklorist focused on Irish mythology and fairies, and the author of numerous books, including their new book, Celtic Fairies in North America. We're so glad you're here, Morgan.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's been a while since we've had you on, so I'm so excited that you're here.
I love how it's like, Morgan Daimler is the author of numerous books. I'm like, yeah, look up Morgan Daimler on Amazon and you got to scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll to find all their titles, man.
Don't do it. It's a trap.
I did it yesterday and it was a trap. I'm still there. I never came out.
I love it. So what have you been up to lately besides writing 20 more books?
keeping busy, you know, always writing something. I just finished a piece, actually. It's for an anthology, so it's, not even technically an anthology, but it's a chapter in a book on the Cottingley fairy hoax, which I think is one of the most fascinating things that happened in the 20th century.
Okay, so give us the Reader's Digest version. Kanani's nodding because she knows I don't remember this one. Please tell us.
Sure. So the Cottingley fairy hoax was a case in the early 20th century where these two girls, this was during World War I, had been telling their parents that they had been encountering fairies at this particular stream, the Cottingley Beck, and the parents did not believe them, shockingly. So they convinced one of the girls, they were cousins, I should say, they convinced one of the girls' fathers to lend them his camera, which was a huge ask, by the way, in like 1917. Like, you did not just lend teenagers your extremely expensive camera equipment, but he did. And they produced these series of pictures, which featured the younger girl, who I think was 10 or 11 at the time, with these small winged dancing fairies. And it actually kind of blew up in the spiritualist and theosophist communities at the time in England. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle jumped in and was sort of very pro the fairy pictures, wrote an article about them, which ended up being published, and it got a lot of attention. And it ended up being this huge controversy because some people believed they were genuine and many people believed they were not. They could not find any proof that the photos themselves had been faked on the film, because that was a common trick from like the late 19th century, where people would fake like spirit photos by messing with the photographic plate. So then the picture would come out with like ghostly images and things. And there was no evidence of that with these. So it kind of lent an air of credibility. And it maintained itself until, I believe it was the 1980s, when one of the girls finally, you know, obviously not a girl anymore, you know, as an elderly woman, came forward and said that the children had faked the pictures, that they had cut out from a book these images of these fairies. And then very old school teenage ingenuity had like propped them up with sticks and, you know, made it look like they were really there. And because of the,
oh my God.
Yeah. Because of the quality of the photos at the time, it's all black and white. It's fairly low resolution. You actually can't tell looking at the pictures immediately that they're fake. Once you know they're paper cutouts, you can kind of see it then. But yeah, so then it's just been a really huge thing in the community for a long time. So, and the anniversary of it obviously was recently, the 100-year anniversary. So there's been a lot of stuff going around about it.
And the girls, if they had been born maybe 60, 70 years later, they could have been part of the CGI development revolution and made a ton of money. But, you know, but this is another way to be remembered, I guess.
Yeah. And it's really fascinating how even today there's people who still believe at least one of the pictures was genuine, that the others were faked, but that there's one genuine picture in there. There's people who will still argue that the girls did have genuine experiences and genuinely had these encounters, but they faked the pictures to try to prove it, so that other people would believe
them. The mental gymnastics of the wishing well, the, what do you call it? I don't know. I'm so tired. Wishful thinkers. The wishful thinkers.
Yeah, but it's a fascinating thing. So my article for the book is looking at the way that theosophy and the Victorian era influenced fairy beliefs and kind of shaped the hoax and how it came out. So that's what I've been up to.
Just, you know, a little bit of that, a little bit of this, that, a little bit of that.
I think that that's true, too, is that's kind of the irony when it comes to these kinds of, you know, frauds and cons, that there are people that are just so unwilling to admit that they've been conned, that they will, you know, do these mental gymnastics to, you know, well, somehow they magically caught a fairy. Like, maybe those other ones weren't, you know, genuine, but somehow they, you know, actually did get a picture, or, you know, the ways that people won't just admit, hey, they did a good job. They convinced you of something that wasn't true. It's just not true.
You know, I think a lot of it is just rooted in how much some people want proof to base their belief in. Because I think if you have a genuine belief, you don't need the proof necessarily. You know, if you believe something like ghosts or fairies or angels or what have you genuinely exists, like, you don't have to catch them on camera for yourself. But I think that for a lot of people, they need that tangible proof to really justify themselves, I think. My impression.
I agree. And I think also sometimes it's not just even for people themselves. I think it's because of people don't want to feel foolish to others. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's like they want the proof, not necessarily because it will help them believe, because they so strongly believe. They want the proof to be able to, like, hold it over others, to be like, see, I'm right. See, this is, you know, I'm not crazy for thinking this.
And also, there's when you've believed in something so, and I'm sure there are people who had this with QAnon as well, like, when you believe in something so much and then you find out that that's not real, it starts to crack into then what really is real. I mean, this is going to sound really deep and morbid, but I think a lot of kids felt this way. When I found out that, you know, the truth behind Santa Claus, I immediately started questioning the existence of God. I'm like, well, if that's not real, then what about God? I mean, and that was really scary for me as a kid. Like, oh, shit. There's, like, a lot of things that may not be real in this world, you know, but
yeah. I think it would be easier with some of the fairy stuff if people weren't fixating on things that are so easily disproven.
Yeah. Right.
You know, like, anyone who knows me on social media has heard my many, many rants about pareidolia and the way that people will pick, like, patterns in leaves or patterns on bark or, you know, other random nature things, and then be like, oh, but you can see there's a little fairy man in this, and it proves it. I'd recently had a conversation with someone online who shared some, like, Ring camera footage of what was pretty clearly a bug moving across the camera, you know, and he was just so adamant that it was a fairy. It was proof that it was a fairy. There was nothing else it could possibly be. You know, and I think that that is having the opposite effect of helping us not look foolish.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. When you look at something that is clearly fake or clearly doctored or clearly not what it is, and you're trying to adamantly say that that's what it is. Yeah. It's not helping the cause.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's helping no one.
Exactly. Well, you've written so many books, as we've talked about before. What was there anything in particular that inspired Celtic fairies in North America?
Like so many of my accomplishments in life, that would be spite.
Spite twins for life. Yeah. Hey, Morgan, let's get matching tattoos that say spite twins.
Don't tempt me, because I'll do it.
I will too. That gets the Kanani seal of approval.
Yeah.
Success through spite.
Success through spite. That's
what we need to get.
Success through spite.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm down for that.
I've done a lot of things in my life based on spite. And this book, what it really came down to is I had a lot of people asking me, which is fine. That's not where the spite comes in. But then when people would ask and I would say, well, yes, you know, we have this evidence or whatever, I would always get this flood of people who were just adamantly like, no, that's not possible. That's ridiculous. This is just like some modern, weird, you know, perspective that you're trying to push on people. And it actually, we have like as far back as we have Europeans in North America, we have folklore about fairies following them or being experienced by them. So yeah, purely out of spite, I wrote an entire book about all of the evidence that we have across 400 years of North American, European settler, you know, folklore, colonialist folklore, I guess we would say. But yeah, so pure spite.
So one of the things that I think is so interesting is the concept for me, because you kind of talk about in the book how, you know, Celtic fairies can have made their way over to North America. Mm-hmm. And the irony to me is why that seems illogical to people, right? Because if you believe it, as a purely spirit entity, well, why would a spirit entity have any geographical boundaries, right? That doesn't make sense. And if you think of it as something kind of in between spiritual and physical, you know, there are maybe people just don't know that there are airplanes and boats, you know, and things that can travel physical things from one landmass to another, you know, like that's how we get all kinds of different kinds of migration and things like that. So to think that, you know, a fairy can't hitch a ride, right, on a boat, you know, or whatever, it's just kind of, it's funny the things that people will dig their heels in on.
Now I'm picturing a bunch of fairies like stowed away in the hold of like a Ryanair plane.
Right?
You know,
like, why not? Fuck it. They can do whatever they want. Well, who's going to stop them?
You know, honestly, I think what it comes down to is a lot of people, when they conceptualize fairies, they really strongly think of them as land spirits and nature spirits and sort of tied to very specific locations, which is surprisingly a very modern view. I'm going to like shake my fist and blame Theosophy for this on principle, but I think a lot of people are.
I was going to blame Ferngully, but you know, you do what you do.
Yeah. I mean, Ferngully is a great example of sort of the distilled concept. You know, the idea that fairies are just these twee little things and that they're very tied to a specific location and they really can't go anywhere else or be anywhere else, which is completely contradicted by pretty much all the folklore we have, unless we're getting into like actual land spirits as a category, which is sort of an ongoing debate about whether we should even consider those fairies or whether those are like a separate, but maybe adjacent concept. But I think because so many people see them that way, you know, if you're viewing it as a land spirit, something that's tied to this rock or this waterfall or this tree, then I can see the logic. Yeah, then it can't, how's it going to go anywhere else? It has to be with that rock or that tree or whatever. If you kind of look at the wider folklore and sort of the range of these beings and see all the stories we have about them traveling, even within their locations, like it's pretty well known in Irish and Scottish folklore that the good folk change homes at certain times of year, that they'll go from one fairy hill that they live in to another, one location to another. So there's already this sort of concept that they can be kind of transient, that they're not anchored just to one place so much as sort of an interlocking web of places. And I'm going to stop going off on a whole tangent now.
I love it, though. We like the tangents.
We love your tangents. Your tangents are fantastic. So, I mean, you kind of started along this path, but my next question was, like, what is a common misconception that people have about fairies that live in North America?
Sure. I think, honestly, the biggest thing that confuses people, in my opinion, is this sort of idea that they're, you know, much like Highlander, there can be only one. And so if we accept that there could be, you know, Celtic cultural fairies in North America, people will act like, well, then that must be everything. That's all that's here. And it just doesn't work that way. There's a ton of indigenous spirits and a ton of indigenous concepts that are similar. I would not call them fairies, but are similar to what we would call fairies in English. And there's also, you know, as anyone who's familiar with the United States and its history is aware of, so many other cultures that have impacted the land here. And, you know, through a variety of methods, whether it's colonialism or immigration or what have you, besides what's indigenous to here, we have all these different layers of types of spirits and types of beings. And it's a much more complex picture than just, you know, there's one thing here. Like, I've heard people try to argue, well, the only thing that's here would be indigenous spirits. Or, you know, if Celtic spirits are here, then that must be the only thing you could possibly encounter. And it's no, it's very, very complex and nuanced and honestly really fascinating, in my opinion, how much is going on. And I don't think that's just true for the United States, to be clear. My book is on North America, so I do talk about Canada and Mexico to a degree. Unfortunately, I am not fluent in Spanish. My Spanish is very, very sad. So I was a little limited in the research that I could do kind of in that area, but I did still find material. There are still beliefs, you know, European beliefs that were brought over and exist in Mexico relating to these spirits. So it's a beautiful and fascinating subject.
You know, I don't think I've ever told this story on the podcast, but I think it really relates to what you're saying is that, you know, that these beings have their own agenda and do impact the land that we live on for their own purposes. Because I remember being at some kind of, in some kind of fairy class or fairy ritual at some pagan gathering. I don't remember what it was, and I don't think it was particularly accurate to the folklore. But in the meditation, I saw these beings building these mounds and labeling all of them Google. And I came out of it and I was like, what? I must be like, my subconscious is infecting this. I'm spending too much time online, whatever, whatever. A few years later, I found out that Google had been funding the building of those very same mounds that I saw in my vision on Governor's Island in New York City.
Interesting.
And so I was like, y'all, nobody should go to those at night ever. Just in case, because somehow they've managed to get Google money to do something out on Governor's Island.
That's like Faye propaganda department worthy.
I'm just like,
that is totally
I'm sure that we're going to see something out there where they're like, Courtney Weber says that fairies work for Google. Okay, fine, whatever. Just let me know when you tag me when you see it, Morgan.
Courtney Weber said that Google works for fairies.
I would put nothing about put it nothing against it, but all I'm saying, friends, is that if you go to Governor's Island and you see those mounds, just don't stay overnight. You know, get back out while the sun's still up. That's all. That's all I'm saying. That's just all I'm saying.
So, in your book, what kind of fairies do you say people can find in North America?
I mean, honestly, I think you can find pretty much everything here. Particularly so in my research and in my personal experience, I think this is my personal theory, brace yourselves. I think that what happens is when communities come over or individuals that have a very strong connection to these sorts of spirits, then some of these spirits at least will also come over. So for example, we have a lot of folklore in various mining communities, many of which, you know, are people who emigrated from Wales, of Tommyknockers, or knockers is what they're called in Wales. Tommyknockers tends to be the name over here. And they're very similar here compared to what you have in Wales, very similar concepts. One of the most common individual types of fairies that we find mentioned across a whole range of sources, the older material and even modern ones, is the Banshee. The idea that this is a female fairy. For those who don't know, this is a female. The term literally means female fairy woman. And whether or not she's actually a fairy would be a whole other episode and a lot to discuss. But for our purposes here, we'll just go with that she is. And she would attach to particular families. And there's various reasons why that can happen. A lot of times it has to do with her being like an ancestral spirit connected to that family line one way or another. And so we have stories of people who came over here or whose families within one or two generations had emigrated, experiencing the Banshee, hearing her. She'll show up before someone dies and wail and cry. And, you know, one of my personal experiences, which I can't remember if I mention it in the book. I don't think I mentioned any of my personal experiences in that particular book, but I know I've shared it on social media before. My ex-husband was actually a McCarthy, and McCarthy is one of the families that is supposed to have a connection to this type of spirit. There's particular named families in Irish folklore that are known to be connected to types of banshee. And the McCarthys are connected to a banshee called Cleanna, who is also a goddess. She's also a fairy queen. She's very multi-purpose, like that. Amazing. But one night, I was asleep and I woke up from a sound sleep. And so did my ex-husband. We were still married at the time, to what I can only describe as, well, first of all, the most eerie, unnerving sound I have ever heard in my entire life. And if I never hear it again, that would be perfectly fine with me. But it sounded like a cross between a woman screaming and the sound the wind makes when a window is cracked and it's really windy outside. I don't know how familiar people are with that noise. Sort of a high-pitched, a drone almost. It was honestly, and I've heard a lot of noises. We have Fisher cats where I live, and they sound like small children being murdered when they scream in the swamp. Amazing. If you've never heard that, Google it, and it's really terrifying. I've heard raccoons fighting. I've heard coyotes. I've heard all sorts of like natural noises around here. I have never heard anything remotely like that sound. And it woke us both up. And I actually think, as strange it is for my area, we ended up having a small earthquake the next day. So I don't know if those two things were connected, but it was very weird. And I'm firmly convinced it was a banshee. I can't imagine what else it could possibly have been. They're kind of known for that weird screaming, wailing.
Yeah, I told the story in my Morgan book about a friend of mine. I'm not going to say their family name because I don't have that permission, but I do. They let me mention it in the book. But, you know, she had a banshee experience in Selwood, Oregon, but a full-on manifestation, like looking out the window and saw the woman out there screaming and thought that she was someone who had escaped or had wandered away from a nursing home down the road, except she was dressed all in black and her face was covered. And, you know, she goes outside to help her and she's not there. She goes back inside. There she is again. She's screaming. She's looking out there. And she just, it kept happening. And then the next day she found out that her mom had passed away. You know, so that it happens even out here in Oregon, where there's not like, there's not the deep European, fresh off the boat immigrant community that you find more in on the East Coast. Out here, people have been in the United States, or white people or colonizers have been in the United States for a lot longer than that. So you don't have that. It's not so tightly tied, you know, but still she showed up.
Yeah.
So I terrified an entire college class when I was talking about the Morgan this way. Someone goes, how do we protect ourselves from her? And I said, don't, don't be of Irish descent. I don't know.
You know, and it's funny because I think, speaking of misconceptions, I think a lot of people, you know, misunderstand the banshee a little bit because they think that she is what causes the death, or that she is like a dangerous spirit. Now, to be fair, there is some folklore. If you make her mad or steal her comb or, you know, do specific things to aggravate her, then yeah, she can potentially be dangerous to you. But when she appears with the mourning and the keening and the crying and the wailing, it's really just to like, give you a heads up, like something's going to happen. You know, it's a warning. It's not that she's going to cause it. You know, she's not there to take that person out necessarily. It's just to let you know so that you're aware that this is coming, that this is going to happen. But a lot of people, I think, just associate her because she's connected to death with, like, she's the one who causes it. If she shows up, if you can just ward her off. There's actually a really, really good, it's an Irish language short film, but I think it has English subtitles. I honestly, I'm sorry, I can't remember. But the whole premise of it is this man starts to see and hear this banshee, and he's doing all of these things to try to sort of chase her away, get rid of her. And I won't tell you exactly how it ends because it's very sad, but he ends up basically causing the death in his attempts to get rid of her. So it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it's a really good
movie that came out. Was this a movie that came out just a few years ago? Was it Banshees of it was about the two men that stopped being friends.
No, that's a full length movie.
Okay.
This is a short film. If I can find it, I'll send the link.
Yeah.
Just content warnings, you know, for death of child. Yeah.
As long as it's not the dog, I can't when the dog dies. I can't do it.
It is not. It actually, I thought it was a very, very well done short film because you get, even though it's fairly short, you get very invested in kind of what's happening, and it builds in such a way that you know something tragic is going to occur because the guy is just getting very agitated and very upset. Which, to be fair, like, he's constantly hearing this banshee screaming. And seeing her, and it was really, really well done, but just kind of illustrates that, like, she's not the one who caused the death. If he had just calmed down and just waited to see what would happen, then it might have been okay. But because he gets so upset that she's there and makes all this effort to get rid of her, it ends up causing the problem, if you will.
It's not just called straight up Banshee, is it? Because I'm looking it up right now. Irish short film.
It's a short gothic. It's black and white, or sepia toned, if I remember. It is an Irish language film,
right? Cry of the Banshee. No, all right. Now I'm just like I'm not gonna.
She's down the rabbit hole now. We've now lost down the rabbit hole.
I've lost it. All right, I'm gonna stop with this because otherwise we'll just be here while I Google search.
You talked about, like, some of the misconceptions and stuff that people have with, you know, the fairies that are around here and whatnot. What if people did want to learn about, or I dare I say, interact with or appease
the
local fae? I think appease is probably a better word. Keep calm. What would be good ways for people to go about that?
Sure. So, usually the first thing that I recommend, particularly people in North America, is try to get a sense or a feel for what's around you. So I do encourage people to try to learn as much as they can about indigenous spirits that might be around them, so that they're sort of correctly identifying whatever they're dealing with or encountering. I get asked this question a lot by people who want to have experiences with particular types of beings, which is a slightly different angle to this. And then it usually comes down to, you know, learn as much as you can about the folklore. The folklore exists for a reason. Yes, I am horribly biased because I'm a giant folklore nerd, but, you know, it's there because it's generations and generations and generations of experience that people have had, you know, good, bad, neutral, random. It's all of this material, but when you get familiar with it, you'll kind of get a sense for, okay, if I hear this unearthly wailing at night and I maybe see this shrouded figure, or, you know, there's a couple other ways that the banshee can appear, but, you know, I see this figure, maybe that's a banshee because that's sort of their MO. And then I should be aware that that usually is foretelling a death or a tragedy of some sort. You know, if I work in the mines of any type under the ground in the earth and I'm hearing knocking noises, that's probably knockers. And then there's particular ways, once you kind of have a sense for what it might be, that you would then want to interact with it. You know, like the tradition with the knockers was that you would share your food with them. That's what the miners would do, is they would eat and then save like the last portion of what they were eating, usually pasties, but whatever it was. And then that would be given to these mine spirits as sort of an offering. You know, food's always a good way to make friends. Usually works well. If you think that you have, for example, like members of the Aishi, the good folk in Ireland around you, there's certain ways you would want to interact. You want to be respectful. You never want to say out loud that you don't believe in them or that you don't respect them. They take that really badly, and then bad things happen. So you always want to be polite and respectful and assume that they're around somewhere and they can hear you. You'd want to give them, particularly milk, is something we see a lot in the stories, people leaving it out for them or pouring it out on the ground for them. In my family growing up in the Irish-American diaspora, my grandfather was from Cork. He always had a thing when he was outdoors, particularly with beer, of pouring the first bit out after he opened it as a gift to the good folk before he would drink any. And we were always told, you know, growing up, if you drop food, that's because the fairies want that, and then you have to give that to them. There was no 5-second rule in my household. It was, you know, if you drop food, it's because the fairies want it and it belongs to them. So, you know, things like that you can kind of incorporate into your life, if that answers the question. But it depends a lot on what exactly you think might be around you or what you want to be around you.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's similar to, you know, if you're trying to impress new coworkers or impress a new boss or something like that, or you're getting to know someone, you kind of want to do your research, you know, what are they like? What are they not like? You know, just kind of get to know them so that you can best approach them and, you know, communicate and or not. Ideally, just not piss off is mostly your goal. Mostly your goal should just be don't piss them off.
Yeah. Which is true for human communities too. Like if you want to incorporate with like a new human community, a good rule of thumb is don't go in there and immediately make everyone hate you.
Exactly. Just don't be a douche.
Show up with cookies. That's a good way to go. My question, Morgan, is when you drop the food, what do you do with it? Does it go outside? Does it go on a special plate? Does it go someplace that's like, oh, this is the fairies now?
So growing up, it would get tossed outside very unceremoniously. The Irish American diaspora, by the way, for people who aren't familiar with it, is a very, very bizarre community. I say that with a great deal of love, but I'm not wrong. Because there's this weird tension between like you believe in things, but you don't. It's this very skeptical kind of belief. Like people will say like, oh, no, we don't believe in that, but you're just not going to eat that food. Just throw it outside because the fairies want it. It's like, okay, sure. That makes sense. In my house, though, because we are, of course, more overtly pagan, we have a little plate and stuff gets put on there. And that sort of anything that we think, you know, belongs to them or is going to them gets put there. And then, you know, once a week or so, I'll dispose of it myself. But it's like a little fairy collection plate.
I know people will ask this. How do you dispose of it?
So before I answer that, which is going to get everyone mad at me, to explain the why, the belief is, and this is a belief across Western European fairy belief. You find it in Ireland, Scotland, even, you know, in England, depending on which sources we're looking at, just an idea that's sort of key to the idea of fairies is that when they take things, particularly food, they're not taking the physical item necessarily. I mean, sometimes they will, and I've had some very weird things happen when I give them food, but usually what's happening is they're taking the essence out of that food. It's called the quintessence, I think, by W.Y. Evans Wentz and the Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries. Reverend Kirk in the Secret Commonwealth calls it the foison, which is a Gaelic word. It just means like substance, fruit. So there's different terms for it, but the concept is all the same. It's basically, this is how I explain it to my children. It's basically taking the soul, the spirit, out of the item, whether it's milk or a cookie or whatever. So the physical part gets left behind, but the value, the reason you would want to eat it, the living aspect of it, is what they take. And once they take that, the physical part that's left behind is basically like an empty candy bar wrapper. So we find in the folklore a lot of traditions that sort of say, well, yeah, animals are going to eat this, or, you know, what have you, and that's fine. It doesn't matter. There is at least one source, and I think this is Lady Wild, but I'm not 100% sure, who mentions that it was believed that if animals ate these offerings, the animal would get sick. Because the idea is there's no value, there's no substance to that food item anymore. But it's sort of just accepted that the physical bit that's left behind has no value. It's not important. It's basically rubbish. So what I usually do is leave it for a minimum of 12 hours, preferably at least 24. Like I said, in my house, we do it once a week just because I have a lot going on in my house and it's easier. But then I will usually throw it away. To be honest, you see why I prefaced saying that with everything else first.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, if I just came out of the gate,
I just know it's always those are always the questions we get from people about offerings. They that's like the anytime we mention in an episode offerings, we immediately get bombarded with questions from people going, "But what do you do after?" And I agree. I've that's the same thing that I've done with my offerings in the past as well. That was my kind of my understanding is they're not going to physically, I have not had any instances where they physically take them more so than it's just you're offering essentially the essence of what that item is. Yep. And just as the item loses its natural value by, you know, getting old and stale and whatnot, right? You're tossing it because it's not, you know, it's no longer a, you know, fresh cookie or, you know, fresh, you know, juice or whatever it is. So
it doesn't have any value left. I will say there was one time I offered whiskey, and don't ask the context of this because it's weird. I don't drink alcohol, so I don't know what alcohol protocol is, but I'd offered it in a teacup because I have a little space up where no one can reach it. My kids can't get to it. My cats can't get to it. And I have a little teacup and I have a little plate, and that's where stuff goes. And I'd filled the teacup with whiskey as an offering. And when I came down the next morning, everything was gone. Like the teacup, there was like a brown residue, like coating the inside, but all of the liquid was gone. And to this day, I cannot explain that.
Well, yeah, I mean, whiskey, when you leave it out, will evaporate and will do just that.
Yeah.
But the fact that it happened that fast.
Yeah, it was less than 12 hours.
Yeah, no, that...
Yeah, that shouldn't happen that quick.
That shouldn't happen. Like, when I've left whiskey on altars and it's, you know, it's been a few days, I will notice that it reduces and it's, you know, eventually it'll be brown sludge. But in 12 hours, unless your cat started telling stories and reliving its glory days and crying in the corner,
exactly.
It was probably someone else got it.
Yeah, no, if the cat had gotten up there, the whole thing would have been knocked over.
Yeah,
I don't care what people tell you about cats. At least mine are not that graceful when it comes to things
exactly.
Like that. I've also had some weird experiences where, not in my house per se, but my friend has a store, and we have little altars there, as you do in a witchy store. And there's one for the good folk. And there was one time, and it was the middle of summer, for whatever reason, she decided to give them some crab rangoon. Which I've realized sounds very strange, but in the context of the moment...
I mean, that's how you'd make friends with me. I'm just saying.
You know,
sharing... That appeases me.
Yeah. And I will emphasize again, this is the middle of summer. I did not expect it to last long. I was keeping an eye on it because I was going to get rid of it as soon as it started to get funky. That thing was on there for like over a month, and it never got weird. It never got moldy. It never changed in any way. It was very strange. So sometimes when you offer things to the good folk, weird things happen.
That's fair. And also I'll put the caveat out there for folks as well who might be inclined to want to put it outside, which is, you know, Morgan mentioned a lot of people have done that historically. Think about the wildlife, and you don't, you don't want to make, I mean, it's possible that the animals got sick because, just like Morgan said, the essence is gone, but it's also equally likely that those animals were eating something they shouldn't have been eating.
Yeah.
You know, and so just be mindful of that. And it's better to be more respectful of the wildlife than, you know, worry too much if your M&Ms go in the trash or not.
Yeah. And I'll add to that, because that's something that's a great point, and I usually mention that in my books too. But I'll add to that, if you plan to put it outside, if this is something that you would normally make your offerings outside or whatever, not only be aware of like what is and isn't good for the wildlife, but also just be aware of like what is and isn't good for the environment more generally. Like pouring milk out in the same location, you'll get fungus growing. It can mess up the plants. Alcohol will kill the plants if you just keep pouring it in the same location. You know, things like that. If you're going to offer anything that has any kind of seeds to it that are invasive or non-native, this is why I do things inside. Because I'm too lazy to plan well enough to worry about all these details, but you should if you're doing it outside.
Yeah, and you can compost or you put it in yard waste if you're concerned about that. But that's one of my soapbox things. It's easy to get me up there, like, y'all, it's okay.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you talked about some of the different things that you can like use then put out for offerings and things like that. What are, let's talk about the opposite of that, which are, because on one hand you want to appease them, but if someone feels like they're having some difficulty, or maybe they have somehow stepped on the wrong side of the good folk, what are some good things to do or have or put out or have around your home?
So if you're looking on a more apology end of things, an actual verbal apology is a great way to start. There's a very well-established belief that these are beings who can be invisible. They can be around us at points when we might not be aware that they're there. No matter how witchy or pagan you might be, don't assume that because you're like someone who's witchcraft inclined that you would necessarily always know that these types of spirits are around, because they're sort of infamous, I guess, pun intended, for being around when people aren't aware of them. And they can hear things you say. And I mention this a lot, particularly because I find that a lot of people into paganism and witchcraft really like the mental communication, the idea that you go and stand in a quiet place and you just think really focused, you know, what you're trying, like you would if you were praying to like a god or a goddess. When it comes to the good folk, though, I really encourage people to say things out loud. Especially if you've messed up and you want to apologize. Just, you know, my bad. Didn't mean to do that. Sorry if I've offended you. Here is, gifts go a long way, especially food. Here is, you know, a bowl of cream or some fresh bread that I've made, or cakes, or, you know, whatever things that they traditionally are known to like. And let's just be friends, and please don't be mad at me anymore. You know, that sort of a thing. I will say that the good folk are pretty well known, again, for holding a grudge. So sometimes when you make them mad, no matter what you try to do to sort of make that better, you're not going to have any luck with it. And it can be over things that we might perceive as small or almost inconsequential, you know, different perspectives when you're not human. In that case, your best bet is to go more on the protection end of things. Iron, Rowan and red thread, Rowan in general, if you can get a hold of it, is a good protection. Iron, you have a ton of options. Steel, I will mention, works just as well. I know sometimes there's some confusion with people on that one. They think you have to get like actual iron, but steel also works. And we find that reference a lot in the folklore too. Salt, carrying salt in your pockets. It gets a little tricky because there is no one thing that would protect against any and all types of otherworldly beings. Much like, you know, with the getting to know what's around you and what they do and don't like, different things work on different types of beings. So iron is sort of the one that you'll see the most often recommended, which is great, but it doesn't work on everything. Salt is another good go-to, but it doesn't work on everything. So if you feel like you're having massive issues and you just want that extra protection, you might have to either layer up and go with a bunch of options, or kind of trial and error till you figure out what's going to work. My main recommendation is don't annoy them to begin with.
Yeah.
Don't, or like you said, quickly apologize.
Yeah.
Out loud.
Yes. Out loud.
I think that's a really great suggestion too. Because like you said, a lot of times people think of communication with spirits or otherworldly beings, and they think of it, you know, as an internal dialogue. Which can sometimes be true. I've had those experiences, but it can also be an audible dialogue as well. And so, you know, sometimes, especially, you know, like you said, with a fae, it can be helpful to actually say it out loud.
Yeah. I'm not saying they can or can't read your mind if it comes to that. Just that sort of the bulk of what we have for people's past interactions with these beings indicate that you're better off saying it out loud.
And they may just, even if they can read your mind, they would like to see you try.
Yeah.
You know, as we all would.
Yeah, it's that effort. Like, they can know that you're sorry, but saying it is probably more important than just feeling it or projecting it.
Was there anything that surprised you in writing this book? Anything that kind of, when you were digging into the folklore, that you didn't expect or thought was rather interesting?
Oh, there's a lot of it that I thought was really interesting. I actually had a ton of fun researching this one. Because I was aware of parts of it, but I'd never really done a deep dive into the folklore and how far back it went and sort of some of the other things that were going on. Honestly, the biggest thing that surprised me, I think I've already mentioned, which is how common the banshee stories are. I did not realize that is probably 25% of what we have over here. That people still talk about. And this goes back quite a ways, and it's still current. Like, people in the modern day are continuing to have these experiences. Not just me, other people too. But besides that, I think some of what surprised me was how widespread some of the stories were. And that much like in Western Europe, particularly in New England, there's a lot of place names that are after these types of spirits, which is something we see, like I said, in Europe quite a bit. But I really didn't expect to see that over here. I don't know why it surprised me, but it just did, to find out that we have places here that are named after these types of spirits, which sort of indicates normally would indicate a belief that those spirits were in that place. You know, you'd call something like Fairy Hill because that was the hill of the fairies, or, you know, what have you. So, yeah, that was not something I expected.
That is interesting, too, like you said, because then it surprises you when you don't expect it, because you're like, well, of course, that's, you know, why wouldn't you do that? But yeah, that's not typically something you would think of here. I think that's really interesting. And I think, like I said, like you kind of talked about how sometimes, you know, they may attach to families, or they may attach to people, or they may attach, like, trees move. Trees can be transplanted, right? So if you believe that they're only attached to a tree, well, what if that tree goes across the ocean and, you know, is now somewhere else in the world? If you believe it's attached to that tree, then that entity is now, you know, gone with the tree. So yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I think that people can get very dogmatic about it, in this belief that somehow it's just something that exists in Ireland and Scotland and over in Europe.
You know, I think that people, and this is a very common thing, so I'm not criticizing anyone, but I think that people fall into this idea of really trying to see each and every type of fairy, each and every type of, you know, folkloric belief related to them, in these very narrow boxes and categories. And this is, again, like sort of a legacy from the Victorian era and theosophy and wanting everything in neat categories and easy to understand, filing system, basically. And what we actually find is that the whole concept, you know, back the 700, 800 years that we have it in writing, this obviously would be in Western Europe, but it's so messy. You know, like one person's fairy is someone else's incubus, is someone else's elf, is, and they're really, historically, were never clear cut categories or lines. And a lot of times it just came down to who was telling a story or what their perception was of what they'd encountered. And when we come into today, people, I don't think, like that. They want it to be narrowly defined and easily categorized. And that works better if we say, okay, we have the Aeschi in Ireland, and they are only in Ireland. They can only ever be in Ireland because that's their box. That's where they fit. That's where they belong. And then we have a completely separate box in, you know, the United States, for example, and that's just indigenous spirits. And I'm, of course, ignoring the fact that people that say that normally are not paying attention to how many different indigenous groups we have in both the U.S. and North America more generally, how each of those groups has different beliefs and different names for things and different understandings of things. Because as we all know, Native American gets treated as one giant homogenous category, which is
probably
not. But it's that same sort of concept of like, well, this is that box. And then if you go to Wales, they get their own little box. And, you know, what exists in there only is there and can't be anywhere else. And that's just not how anything works in life. You know, like even just like if we look at animals and plants, they go where they want to go, even when they're invasive and destructive. They're still gonna be where they're not supposed to be. And
I mean, I got Himalayan blackberry. I cannot get rid of that stuff. Yep,
we have bittersweet here, and it'll take down trees. I mean, it's horrific, but it's here. It's not supposed to be, but so far, me yelling at it and telling it it's not supposed to be here has accomplished nothing. And I feel like it's a lot like that with different types of spirits. Like they're gonna be where they're gonna be, and they're gonna spread. You know, if it means stowing away in the Ryanair hold, then that's how it's gonna happen.
They fly first class. We all know it. It's fine,
right? Absolutely.
Although first class on Ryanair, I don't know.
Just so much funnier to picture them. Okay, Aer Lingus, we'll upgrade them a little bit.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's just so much funnier to picture them, like, you know, in among the suitcases and the baggage and the Aer Lingus hold, and then like jumping out when the plane lands. A weird sense of humor, sorry. But, you know, I think that humans in general are way too anthropocentric. And I don't think that we have any ability to tell these spirits where they are going to be or where they have to stay or what they're going to do. They're going to do what they're going to do. And I don't think we have as much control over that as we like to think that we do.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I could talk to you for 8,000 more hours because we always love having you on. And you're just like an unending fountain of knowledge, which is amazing. So where can people find you, and what are you up to right now? What can people expect?
So I just finished a new book. It's called Paid with a Kiss, Love and Sex and Fairy Belief. It's exactly what it sounds like on the tin. It basically answering another question that I get asked a lot, is looking at the concepts of love and gender roles and sex in fairy belief. So of fairies, of humans interacting with fairies, of fairies interacting with humans, all of that across the range of Western European folklore. Super excited for it. I think
is this coming out soon, or can I just bribe you to get a preview copy? I'm willing to do very, very awkward things.
Now we're in like a Klondike bar commercial.
Yes.
We'll talk.
What'd you do for Morgan's next book manuscript?
Yeah. This one won't be out till next year. It's just going into copy editing now. But we'll talk. We'll work something out. And I am, like I said, I'm excited. I think that this is a subject there's so many misunderstandings about. Like, if you think there's a lot of misunderstandings about Celtic fairies in North America, that is nothing compared to the misunderstandings when it comes to that topic and the good folk. It's basically like I wrote a whole dissertation on the subject. So that's coming out next year. I just finished it up. Excited for that. Where can you find me? Sadly, everywhere on social media, because it's a plague and they keep starting new ones and everyone's like, we're going to leave this one and go to this new one. And then they don't, but then they're on the new one too. So I have to be everywhere. So, always under my name, Morgan Daimler, except for my Tumblr. If you can find my Tumblr, then you are amazing, because that is the one that is not under my name. Although, if you find it, it's pretty obviously me. But anywhere else...
I don't actually know what Tumblr is. So now I'm going to have to figure out what Tumblr is so that I can then find you on Tumblr. Because now I feel like it's like a personal challenge.
Well, let me know if you do find it. Yeah, everywhere else is just Morgan Daimler. And I will put out the you know, disclaimer that... I never private message people pretty much ever for any reason, and definitely not to offer to do readings or tell you that your soul contacted me or any of that weird stuff that the scammers do. So if you do find
weird energy, you message me for bail though. Like, I understand you're not going to ask for services, but will you be messaging me to bail you out?
I mean, you possibly, but I would definitely expand.
I'm not saying I'm not going to give it to you. I'm just saying we'll have some boundaries here that I understand. You can ask for bail.
Yeah, the boundary will be, though, it'll come with a story about how I jumped into something I wasn't supposed to jump into and chaos ensued.
Time we thought I was going to need bail was when we were planning on me jumping into the Bellagio fountain in Vegas. Nice. We were trying to figure out when the boat came to get me. How, you know, how much was it going to cost to bail me out when they fished me out and then took me to jail?
We had this whole conversation during the intro about why Kanani is not the one who's going to end up getting arrested. Why I'm slightly more the one who's going to get arrested, but I'm actually quite slippery and hard for police to catch. We had this discussion.
But for the record, getting dragged out of the Bellagio pool, I would contribute to that fund. I'd be on
See,
board.
This is going to be a thing. I've started a thing. I want to do it
not
so
me.
Bad.
I'm not paid for your ass to get out.
I want to do it.
Yeah,
it's not good.
This is a lifetime experience.
Right?
And this is.
I don't know what's better, swimming in the fountain or those poor bastards having to fish me out of it. I don't know which pleases me more.
It's amazing all around.
It just is. I'm going to end up on the news. Of all the reasons I could end up on the news, that's probably the most positive.
I think it's amazing. And I'll also record the news clip. Courtney and I were talking before we started recording about the fact that I'm always on social media telling people, like, don't do the thing, be smart, make good choices. But I am the first person who will do the thing. So, yeah, you and I, if we ever hang out in real life, we'll need a chaperone.
Well, we're going to have fun.
We'll need an adult chaperone. Yeah.
We will 100% need a chaperone. 100%. That has to happen. Absolutely.
Yes. Mischief will happen.
I think we might see you this year. Are you going to be at Mystic South this year?
I am.
Yes, they are.
Mystic South.
So we may be, I believe we may be seeing you then. So
we'll have to find a designated adult to hang out with us.
I think I can do that. I can find us one of those. That would be amazing. That would be so much fun. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Like I said, we love talking to you. We love having you join us.
Thank you.
I very much hope we are going to get to see you this summer. That would be amazing. And yeah, people definitely, you want to find Morgan.
You guys are there.
They're everywhere.
Sadly everywhere.
Stop. It is joyfully.
It is joyfully everywhere.
Joyfully everywhere.
Mischievous.
All right, which is... Don't piss off the fairies, and we'll see you next week.
That's right. Bye, guys.
Thank you for listening to That Witch Life podcast. Our music is by Dustin Schultz, editing by Corey Drake. If you like what we do, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts. If you want to support the show, you can buy us a coffee or check out our merch on our Etsy store or join us on Patreon for bonus content, ad-free episodes, or to join our witch squad. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For show notes, audio transcript, or to ask us a question to answer on a future episode, go to thatwitchlife.com. Until then, keep moting that shit. We will talk to you next week.
So mote it be.